Please join me for a dog's breakfast here on CFRU 93.3 FM on Saturday mornings from 10 to 11.
Freak Scene is named after this song by Dinosaur Jr., which probably more than anything gives you a good idea of what you're going to hear. Plenty of hard-hitting alternative. Not to be limited to just that, though. You'll hear everything that rocks. Things might even get mellow every once in a while. You just never know. Check it out Monday nights from 8 to 10 here on CFRU.
We on the left are second to no one in our patriotism. We want perestroika, we want fundamental restructuring and democratization of overseas and domestic policies. We want a restructuring and democratization of the political process, the values, institutions, the economy, and the class power of this country. We real patriots say, along with Albert Camus, I want to love my country and justice too.
That's Michael Parenti, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Michael Parenti on super patriotism. Samuel Johnson in the 18th century said, "Patriotism is the last refuge of scoundrels." Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But for certain today, patriotism is a battleground. Being labeled unpatriotic or anti-American have become routine terms of abuse. Somehow the state has been invested with some extraordinary power, and people are to be silent and obey in respectful awe. As Martin Luther King Jr. said in his great Riverside Church speech in 1967, "Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, citizens do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially," he said, "in a time of war." Perhaps true patriotism would be to raise uncomfortable questions that challenge the official story. Principled dissent has historically been a hallmark of a vibrant democracy. To talk about super patriotism is Michael Parenti. He's one of this country's foremost independent political analysts. He's taught at major colleges and universities in the United States and around the world. He's the author of numerous books, including Democracy for the Few and the highly acclaimed The Assassination of Julius Caesar. This classic from the AR archives was recorded in Boulder, Colorado in 1988.
Well, as a guest on radio talk shows, I have on a number of occasions criticized U.S. foreign policy. And one time an irate caller called in and he said to me, "Do you love your country?" And the question was obviously rhetorical, because here was someone who saw fit to question my patriotism because I was questioning the policies of our leaders. That's really strange when you think about it. The caller was manifesting a symptom of what might be called super patriotism, also sometimes called stupor patriotism, also called pseudo patriotism, a phenomenon best defined as the willingness to follow our leaders uncritically in all their dealings with other nations, especially when those dealings are confrontational and belligerent and they involve a question of national pride or the use of military force. That's the definition of super patriotism. This super patriotism, or American chauvinism, has been with us throughout much of our history. It certainly is a very effective instrument in discouraging and discrediting critical public discourse. Well, I think it's time that the super patriots account for their brand of patriotism, and has explained to us what it's all about. For instance, what do they mean when they say they love their country? What do they mean by country? You know, academia is not totally without certain virtues. You learn to ask a lot of trivial, detailed questions in any case. So I asked myself, what do you mean by country? Do they love every region and locale in the United States? Well, obviously, very few of us have been to every region and locale, and nor would all of us find all the regions and locales all that lovable. Does love of country mean loving the American people? Well, again, even the most gregarious among us have met only a relatively small portion of the American people, and I would bet that the super patriots don't particularly love whole sectors of the American public, especially the more bigoted super patriots. In fact, rather dislike to associate with or have any positive identification with certain people because of reasons of ethnicity, religion, race, and class. Do super patriots love America for its history and culture? Again, I'm really skeptical of that because it's my impression that they know very little about American history and culture, or rather, much of it is rather unappreciated by them. Furthermore, there's a terrible side to our history that's really not all that lovable. For instance, the extermination of Native American Indian nations, the enslavement of African people, the aggressive wars against Vietnam, Mexico, Canada. We lost 1,000 men on one attack on Canada, I just learned a little while ago. Central America, the Philippines, and elsewhere. Nor might we all be that enamored with certain aspects of American culture, certainly not the mind abuse of primetime television, the commercialism, the corporate greed, the ecological devastation, the economic and racial injustice. If I'm being asked to prove my patriotism by loving American popular culture, then I might fail the test, I guess. The America that the super patriots claim to love is neither a geographical totality, nor is it a vast population, nor is it really a history or culture. As far as I can see, their America, and they say love America, is an ideological abstraction. It's an emotive symbol that can be embodied in other abstract symbols like the flag. It's a sort of almost a love without content. I mean, how else can you love a flag? I mean, a flag, as you know, is a piece of rag on a stick. And it's got colors and things. And if you love that flag, and that flag's a symbol of your country, it's a kind of love that doesn't seem to have a content to it. Well, having said that, let me contradict myself. Because there is one real content to the super patriotism. Its main substance is militarism. The pacifist and political scientist and activist, by the way, good pacifists are not passive, they're pacifists, and they're quite active. The pacifist and activist, Milford Sibley, he once noted, quote, "Patriotism for most professional patriots seems to be inseparably connected with military violence and war." Indeed, the most militaristic among us seem to think that they are the most patriotic. Isn't that rather extraordinary? Patriotic virtues are equated with military ones. Our history's patriotic vignettes are usually military ones. Valley Forge, the Alamo, Gettysburg, the battleship Maine, Pearl Harbor, raising the flag on Iwo Jima, D-Day, the MIAs and POWs, and the like. Our country, right or wrong, but mostly our country at war or ready for war. The commemorations of our national leaders during national holidays would be incomplete without the marching troops, the weapon displays, martial music, formations of fighter planes zooming overhead. Even in local communities, when they organize patriotic celebrations, they usually appear the marching bands in semi-martial uniforms, the high school cadets with rifles on their shoulders, and if there's an army base nearby, even troops. I remember once sitting in Urbana, Illinois, standing there July 4th, watching this parade come by, and on this float was suddenly this missile, sort of small missile, but there was this instrument of death on this float that was going by, and there were some people around me, and you know what they did? They started to applaud this inanimate object. I mean, there wasn't even a pilot or, you know, somebody else tending to it, or a soldier striding it and waving and going, "Yow, look at me," you know. I mean, it was too much for me. They were just applauding this weapon. And then was a little jet fighter came by on the float, and they started applauding that too. This was at a time when these things were being used in Vietnam. Even July 4th fireworks sometimes themselves, July 4th fireworks are really a benign representation or replication of the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, as the top patriotic song on our patriotic hit parade goes. Max Weber once said that the state's irreducible characteristic is a monopoly on the legitimate use of violence. And to be sure, state ceremonies in most states include some display of military force. Now, the way super patriots express their national pride leaves me uncomfortable. It seems the love we are to have for our country rests on some kind of competition with other countries, that it comes at an expense with other countries. It's a love that is predicated on some invidious comparison to other countries being lesser, being not as good. If we love our country, we have to believe it's better than any other. The super patriots will even ask us, don't you think this is the best country in the world? So that you love it because it's better. It's something better. This, by the way, we might recognize immediately as the being number one syndrome. I guess I must have heard about being number one for a long time, but the first time it ever stuck in my mind was when I heard President Richard Nixon sometime in the late 60s announce, and I quote, America is still number one. The still, of course, hints at some anxiety that there might be some slippage there. So I'm listening to this and I'm saying, okay, number one, that makes me feel, makes me feel like number one, and that's pretty good. But I was bothered by it because it presumed that we were in some kind of adversarial relationship to other nations, all other countries, and that somehow our greatness and our goodness could only be measured in comparison to them, only in our ability to be the top banana. So I said, all right, we're number one. And then one of those troublesome questions came again in my head, and I said, if we're number one, what are we number one in? I mean, what are you number one in? So I thought, I said, population? And then, no, the Chinese walk away with all the awards in that category. Geography? No, I think the Soviets and even Canada has more real estate than we do. We're not number one in size. I think Brazil, there's a number of countries, I think. I don't even want to think about it, about all the countries that might be ahead of us there. Steel production and other basic industries? I perked up a little. Well, we used to be number one in that, but we have slipped down the list because our super patriot corporate leaders have taken to abandoning our communities and exporting our jobs and bringing the factories off to Taiwan and Argentina and South Korea, where they can work for slave labor wages. Which, when you think about it, is not the way for super patriots to act, really, take our factories away and all that. So I said, well, what are we number one? Are we number one in cuisine? Please. I mean, in that category, we are strictly double digits. Way behind, France, China, Japan, Mexico, Italy, India, Greece, and others. Are we number one in trade? I know we used to be number one in trade, but I believe the Japanese have outstripped us, or so it would seem to anybody who's walked into any department store in the last couple of years. So the question remains, I was sitting there saying, well, what are we number one in? And the best I can tell from the super patriotic utterances is that it gets down to two things. One, wealth, with no concern as to how the wealth is distributed and how it's used and for what effects. And military power, with no concern again with how that military power is used and for whose interests that it might serve at home and abroad. A few years ago, President Reagan exclaimed, quote, we are proud of America. We love America. America is the greatest. Now, the greatest, and when you say America is the greatest, that's another way of saying number one. America is number one. Now, supposedly, we can love America and be proud of our country because it's so great. The implication is, however, that if it weren't so great, it wouldn't be so lovable. And that began to trouble me. The super patriot's love of country seems predicated on the country's being up there, stronger and superior to other countries. What happens if it's going to slip? What happens? I started thinking, what about people from lesser lands, as we might call them? I mean, what about somebody from Luxembourg? I mean, now Luxembourg is number 122, you know. I mean, just barely ahead of San Marino in its military might. I said, what does someone from Luxembourg do? Do they go around shamefaced like this, you know? And they say, you from Luxembourg? You from Luxembourg? I said, no, I'm French. No, I'm French. And they say, do you love your country? You know, they say, well, what is there to love? I mean, a few border police, no army, no navy. I mean, it's the super patriots were exhilarated by the U.S. aggression perpetrated against Grenada. To them, such military exploits are an affirmation of our nation's strength and worth, and therefore their own individual strength and worth. I mean, there are some people who went around who really got off on the invasion of Grenada. Said, oh, we really kicked their ass. Oh, whoa, you know, like the Washington Redskins versus St. Mary's Junior High School football team. Oh, we really gave it to them. Ronald Reagan, the conqueror of Grenada, reflecting upon his greatest military victory, hailed the venture as an example of how the U.S. defends democracy. Since the U.S. has taken over in Grenada, Grenada's unemployment rate has tripled. Since it's been liberated from Moscow's yoke, Grenada's native enterprises and development projects and health and education programs that were initiated by the New Jewel Movement have been abolished and been rolled back. Grenada is once more safe for private capital penetration. And the Reagan invasion served notice to the Caribbean nations they had better not try to develop alternative social orders that go against the multinational corporate way of doing things. That's what the invasion was about. And Ronald Reagan was right when he said it's not a question of nutmeg. It was not a question of direct U.S. capital investment in the country, which was small because it's only a country of 110,000 people. It was a question of serving notice to the Caribbean that you cannot be masters of your own destiny. You cannot develop your resources, your labor, your land, your capital, and your technology for yourselves. You are there to be milked by us, that is, by people of Ronald Reagan's class, not by us. We got milked on that too. We paid for that expedition. We paid for that invasion. It was our sons who died in that invasion, and it was more than 18, I assure you. Questions were raised about the number of people killed. Now, most super patriots don't think about Grenada in that way. They think about it the other way. You know, it was a real victory, as I say. But most of the world didn't see that invasion as some kind of victory. It wasn't perceived as a sign of strength by Latin America and most other nations. It was seen as a sign of weakness. It wasn't seen as a glorious thing. It was seen as a shameful thing when the most powerful country in the world has to invade a micro state of 110,000 people and feel proud that they won. There were more citations given for heroism on Grenada than there were soldiers that went. There were literally hundreds of citations for officers, lieutenant colonels, and all that. Many of them never left the Pentagon through that whole operation. And they were all given these citations by Mr. Reagan to validate the heroism, the enormous accomplishment, the patriotism of this great venture. If anything, Grenada ought to make us wonder that maybe America isn't number one. Indeed, there's someone going around this country who's saying that. He's the presidential candidate for the Democratic Party. In a speech in Chicago in March 1988, during the primary campaigns, Michael Dukakis said, quote, "We need a strategy that will make America number one." I said, make America number one? I thought it was number one. I mean, certainly since Grenada were number one. I see that with these liberals sowing seeds of doubt in our minds. The next month in Cleveland, Michael Dukakis announced, "We're going to take charge of our economic future, and we're not going to stop until America is number one." Like all his predecessors, Dukakis doesn't explain what's so important about being number one, or what the hell does it mean to be number one anyway. This preoccupation with being number one strikes me, ladies and gentlemen, as I say, as a sign of weakness, not of strength, as a sign of insecurity, not of security. A people who know who they are don't worry about being number one. A people who are in touch with the deeper values of social justice and democracy don't get a number one thrill from stomping on a tiny nation. A people who seek friendship and cooperation with other peoples don't need to lord it over other nations and outshine them. Such a people don't have to find reassurances in themselves by looking at or imagining the deficiencies of others. And they don't feel threatened by the accomplishments and strengths of other people. They don't panic when they fail to win the most gold medals at the Olympics. You watch the Olympic coverage, it's an amazing case of super patriotism. I remember the L.A. Olympics, the Summer Olympics. There was one swim meet I watched, and the camera was on this American swimmer the whole time. The guy came in third, and as he came in, the announcement of who won, who got the gold and silver, wasn't made by the ABC announcer. You could hear it, like in the pool. It was an off-mic announcement. I suppose you could hear it, but I didn't catch it. And they just kept saying, I forget the guy's name. Well, Tom feels bad about that. Yeah, let's get a replay on that last spin. And the camera followed him getting out of the water and walking along. Yeah, it's really terrible. Yeah. And I'm keep saying, who won that match? Who won it? I mean, who were the other guys? Was anybody else swimming in that pool? And they covered him all the way. You literally could not find out who won it. The Winter Olympics in 84, I noticed as the GDR kept winning more medals, the age at which their athletes began training got younger and younger. They won a few medals, and the announcer said, well, in East Germany, the athletes, I hear the kids, they begin training at 11 and 12 years old. Then they won a few more medals by day three. He was saying, and I hear they begin training at as young as 7 and 8. And by the end, they won a few more medals, and they said, well, in the GDR, they begin training as young as 4 and 5. And there was a cut shot of these little toddlers on the ice skates with their parents. And I say, my God, those commies are just ruthless what they do to their children. Super patriotic morality is an inversion of individual morality. For the super patriot, the nation state is something more than an instrumental value. It's something more than a way of organizing order and law and whatever else to carry out other good things in life. It's not merely an instrumental value. It becomes an end value in itself. Those other things are no longer the end. They become instruments to serve this end. The state is no longer there to serve us. We are here to serve and glorify the state. The state becomes an entity, a force unto itself, a powerfully abstracted symbol that claims our ultimate total loyalty, a moral object, a moral entity in itself whose existence and growth are taken as self-justifying. You know, a question could be raised. What's so important about the state existing and growing and continuing and expanding and flourishing, whatever else? That's taken as self-justifying. In fact, that question would be considered unpatriotic. The moral code that applies to nationalism does not operate the same as the moral code that applies to individuals. The premises that governs all individual morality is that your behavior must at some point lead to self-restraint and even self-sacrifice. In individual morality, there are certain things you should not do, even if they're convenient, advantageous, and whatever else. Even if you have the impulse for them, even if they advance your self-interest, you must not do them. That's what the whole essence or code of individual morality is, as in thou shalt not. These premises are inverted when applied to a nation's behavior, and they often lead to terrible and untrammeled excesses. To err is human, to sin is all too human. But the nation state is something more than human, and there lies the power of its appeal. At the heart of the super patriotic ethic is the belief that the nation's existence and its actions are so endowed with virtue as to place it above the commonplace rules of life. The restraints that apply to ordinary humans don't restrain the nation. So convinced of its supreme virtue, the nation knows no other restraint than the limitations of its own self-interest, its own desires, and the limitations of its own power. So ultimately, the restraint on a nation is the limitation of its power and the power of others. Ladies and gentlemen, the difference between individual morality and national morality is a very real one. When the aggrandizing individual commits an evil or harmful act, there's some sense that he is to be punished, he or she, or should be punished. At least some questions raised about whether proper standards of conduct haven't been violated. But some of the most outrageous acts, which would be outrageous under an individual moral code and unsupportable in civil life, are applauded as heroism when performed in the name of the nation. Thou shalt not becomes thou shalt do anything by any means necessary if it can be said to be in the national interest and if it serves national security. Well, who are the super patriots? They can be found in high and low places. They can be found in the White House, and they can be found in your local American Legion post. But super patriotism, I would argue, is not a product of mass psychology. It's not a product of mass macho psychology as such, although it certainly appeals to machismo. often resorting to a kind of John Wayne approach to foreign policy. I'll give you one quote. President Lyndon Johnson, the U.S. will not act the great giant that is having its hands tied to get pushed around by a little dwarf armed with a penknife. That's Ronald Reagan. That's Lyndon Johnson talking. The little dwarf with the penknife was Vietnam. We've been taught to think that the Archie Bunker is the prototype of the super patriot. In fact, Archie is one of its victims, one of super patriotism's victims. He's one of its consumers. He pays the taxes, he bleeds, he sends his kids off and all that, and he falls for it. The suppliers, the pushers of super patriotism, most conspicuously are our top political leaders, our publicists, our media pundits, our institutional heads, including some college presidents and corporation leaders. Super patriotic ideology is assiduously propagated by the ruling class of this society. That is the essence, that has been the essence of the Reagan propaganda effort over these 8 years. Like the anti-communist ideology, which is just the other side of that same coin, it is not a product of mass hysteria, although its goal often is to instigate mass hysteria. But ideas do not float around in social space. You see, there's no such thing as just an idea around, like a virus. In fact, viruses don't quite float around. They go according to certain social relations. And so with ideas are mediated through social structure, through social organization, through a social system, that is, through organized statuses, roles, groups, families, schools, communities, media, other institutions, whatever else. And some ideas then are mass marketed. Some ideas are taught to us from day one in those little flag salutes we have at school. That Ronald Reagan isn't just getting off in irrelevant things when he talks about flag salutes and prayers in the schools and pushing those symbols in school. He wants to institutionalize, he wants to internalize within kids at the first grade level, if you will, this gut instinct to wave that flag, to rally around that flag, to get in there when it's the Pueblo or the Grenada or Central America or whatever else, and not ask too many questions and just say, my country, and I love my country, and let's do it. I think it's not a manifestation of individual psychology. I think it's a mediated thing, because the super patriotism, machoism, is not something that just swaggers around in any direction. It's directed toward very particular, specific political goals. It has very specific targets, like Cuba, Vietnam, Nicaragua, the USSR, Grenada, countries that are, or in case of Grenada, were developing social orders that threatened global capitalism. But in relation to some other countries, the super patriots aren't so macho. In fact, they're very passive, very suffering, very accommodating, very supportive. They don't have the macho virtues that what the patriarchs would call the feminine virtues almost. They're this way when it comes to Chile, Guatemala, El Salvador, Indonesia, South Africa, Israel, South Korea, Zaire, countries that support the interests of multinational capitalism and imperialism. So psychological categories in politics offer some explanation regarding predispositions, but they do not explain the actual policy directions. For that, you have to look at such things as class interests, economic interests, and other such things. One of the key functions of super patriotism is to blur the differences in class interests in our society and try to convince us that we're all in the same boat, rich and poor alike. You, me, the Mellons, the Morgans, the Rockefellers. We are made to believe that the people of the United States have a community of interest with the giant multinationals, the very companies that at any time might export our jobs and abandon and desert our communities in that very unpatriotic way, as I said before.
You're listening to Michael Parenti on Super Patriotism. This is AR. You can order copies of this program by calling our toll-free number, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
In truth, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, on almost every issue, we the people are not in the same boat with the big financiers and companies. The costs of our policies are not equally shared. We pay the brunt of the costs. The benefits of our policies are not equally enjoyed. We don't get much of that. I give you the case of the Persian Gulf, where it's costing us $2.50 for every dollar's worth of oil that's coming out of the Persian Gulf. That's not so irrational, because we're paying the $2.50 and the oil companies are making